as easily. Why don't we have to do something about it?
Right. I just spent a lot of money on with Dell Computer. And my oldest son works for me. And one of the things we do is provide psychiatric service for people in the criminal justice system. And because some of these prisons are way in the hell out in the middle of nowhere, and some of the parolees are too, and in fact, some of them are out there because they don't want to be supervised. So they get out in these areas that have no population and very few parole officers. You just can't afford to put them out there. So I had to buy all these units, and we're teleconferencing psychiatry. And so, I mean, all of a sudden I'm getting just loads of computer equipment at my house, and it's all coming in, and my son comes in and looks at it and says, what are we going to do with that? And we have to get it out to the parole offices and some of the prisons and do all the rest of that. But if it just sat in my house, that would be faith without works. But once they're out there and they have offender populations in front of them, then you've made it what it had the potential to be. So, huh?
I got one of the Fellowship of Spirits and panel on 567.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody got the defect with a discussion about, after having gone through this, we not to stand up for the truth about this program.
Yes.
In fear of being alienated from the very groups of the city.
Yes.
Produce a meeting for an hour and a half that was probably almost a fifth step in itself. It produced the response from about 200 people that were absolutely new. People that were just balled up with this message and had been afraid and refused to carry it on a regular basis because they just felt brutalized when they did.
Right.
They just brought the people to tears.
That's an example of how many people are out there trying to carry a clear message that are being thwarted by people who don't want to follow the directions. My responsibility is to carry a message which is clear, which is precise, and which is unafraid. That's my responsibility. And I excuse the expression, if I don't have the balls to stand up and do that, that's on me. You know what? Alcoholics, real alcoholics, who want recovery will always, always move towards the truth. Always. And if they're never prevented, or they're never presented the truth, they're going to wander. You know, when God is kind to people who want the truth, I mean, they'll keep, from what I can see, and this is just an observation over many years, God will keep people sober who want sobriety and are willing to do what's necessary to get it, even if they don't know what to do. And they won't ever reach the level of emotional health that they could get by getting the truth, but they will stay sober and their life will become more meaningful. Now, the rub comes in when they're presented the truth. And at least from my observation, what happens is that when they're presented the truth, then they have to do something about it. Now, one of the things you find out in life is that when anyone is presented with the truth, it always requires action, invariably. It's an odd thing, but look at it and see if that isn't true. Truth requires action. When you're presented with it, you got to do something. And if they choose at that point not to do it, my guess is that they go back to drinking, or at least that's what I've observed. But if they're presented with it and their intent is good, then they stay sober and they become more effective because they've been given the truth. The whole point of this is that anyone who comes to this or who is part of your groups can be armed with the truth, and that you will become an effective force in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it may take longer than you think it does, but it always works. The thing that, in the beginning of the book where it talks about the passengers on the ocean liner that sinks, and about how everyone was so happy to have survived, and it says camaraderie pervaded the vessel from captain's to table to steerage, steerage to captain's table. You know what that is? That's an old term. Steerage is the bottom of the ship. It was the cheapest rooms on the ship. It was down in the bowels of the ship. And people that wanted to book really cheap passage would go down there. And it's noisy and it smells and it does all the rest of this. And the captain... Yeah, it was like a caste system on a ship. And captain's table was the best place on the ship. So camaraderie pervaded the ship, and it talks about we had been brought together by a common peril, but we were held together by a common solution. And that's not only true for individuals, it's true for groups. If you watch these groups that don't have a solution, they either fade away or everybody changes. I've got a group right up the street from my home group that I go trolling in that group. And you can go in that group and you can go back to it 3 months later and virtually no one will be the same. And that's a group without an answer. And they're like pass-through groups. But what you can do is you can bring real recovery. All right. Can we just... Yeah, let's do that. Then... We ready to go? All right, let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we're willing to make amends. And then the next line in the book is, we made it when we took inventory. The truth is that if you do this by the numbers, when you get to your 8-step list, you already have it written. Or at least most of it. So, we subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember that we agreed at the beginning that we were willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. Why do you suppose that's in italics right there? Forget what? Why would it be in italics? Why do you suppose they want to make a point out of that? Yes. This is one of the toughest things in the program to do. Here's where you put your pride in your pocket and you go to other people and you talk about how you harmed them and how you're willing to make that right. Making amends is not about apology. Making amends is about balancing the books. And so the question is, I know you did it, but what are you going to do about it? When you go to make these amends, it's good to have some idea about what you're willing to do to make that right if you haven't done that already, okay? A lot of times it's about owing money, which in a practical sense is just about paying it back. Sometimes it's about really creating harm in someone else's life And you have no idea how to make that right. So sometimes it's helpful to ask the other person what they would like you to do. And if it's reasonable, do it. One of the things we were taught, and I'm just going to tell you this now about the ninth step before we get to it, so I don't forget it. But one of the things we were taught to do was when we went to make amends, when we were done making the amend, we would always ask the people, have I harmed you in any way that I'm unaware of? You ought to see the response you get from that. Sometimes you get no response at all, and sometimes they give you another 30 minutes of chapter and verse. I had an ex-wife that I made amends to, and I actually had made amends to her 3 or 4 times, and she was so angry at me after we were divorced that she could go on virtually out for hours. And so she said, there's some other things I want to discuss with you. And the last thing I did was I went to her and I said, I will sit down with you for an hour. And so get everything together you want to tell me. Because this is the last time I'm doing it. And she did. And when the hour was over, I said, thank you very much, and left. And that, other than our children's weddings, I've never had occasion to talk with her. Oh, my. All right. Probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we've hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured to some people we need not, probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. So let's just talk about it. So we go through our inventory, and we want to make amends, and we know that most of those people on our inventory are going to wind up on our amends list. How do we clarify that so we know how to approach them? Any of you guys done that?
You mean like write it out?
Yeah.
Yeah, write it out and share it with my sponsor. And
what do you write out?
That I was wrong.
Yes.
And that I had harmed them. And what I did to harm them.
Yes. Very good. The trick here is sometimes we think that we're such a terrible person that we've harmed everyone that we've crossed paths with. On some of the ones that I was going to make amends to, and it's a good idea to clear this with somebody. I always did it with my sponsor before I made the amend, because my perception's a little faulty. So I would go to him and I would give him the list, and we'd talk about what the harm was and how I could best make the amend. And sometimes I would say, well, I need to go make amends, and he'd say, what's the harm? And I'd go, I don't know. I just don't think I was very nice to that person. And he'd tell me how you harmed him. And sometimes, I believe that if I stayed alongside somebody long enough, I'd harm him. And he went, unless you can come up with some harm, don't be wasting his time. So what he required me to do was write down the nature of the harm and be clear about it. He said, do not be using other people's time. Don't be calling them up and making appointments with them and then go over there and don't know what you're talking about. At least have the decency to be clear about what you had done when you get there. And he said, in your case, I think you ought to get some of those 3x5 recipe cards and write everything down before you go over there so you're clear on why you're there. Like, one of the things I was going to do was I was going to make amends to an old girlfriend. And my motivation wasn't the best. And when I said, well, it's, you know, I did this and that, and he said, you're going over there because you want to get next to her. And I said, I suppose there's a little bit of that. And he said, then you write down how you harmed her. You go there and do your business. Make your amends. And then you get up and leave. And if you want to go back and talk to her, you can do it some point subsequent to your amends, but you don't do it there. And he said, your business in amends is to go do the amend. And that means you clear off your side of the street, and then anything else, any other subject, is superfluous to that particular occasion. Doesn't belong there. So what I did was I went through the whole amends list, and I wrote down who I ought to make amends to and who I shouldn't. When we got down the list to my father, he said, what are you going to do about him? And I said, I'm not going to do anything. And he said, why not? I said, he's the one to beat up on me. You know, I mean, he was the one that was drunk all the time. And I'm not sure I ever created any harm in his life, but he did a hell of a job on me. And he said, this isn't about your side of the street. Or this isn't about his side of the street. This is about your side of the street. And I said, well, what harm did I ever do him? And he said, didn't he used to call you on your birthday? Didn't you tell me that? This is when you think about, why did I ever tell my sponsor all this stuff? And he said, didn't he try to call you on your birthday every year? And I said, yeah. And he said, what'd you do? And I said, I hung up on him. And he said, why? And I said, because he was always so drunk, I couldn't even understand him. I could tell who it was, but I couldn't tell what the hell he was saying. And he said, do you understand how hard it is for a chronic alcoholic to pick one day out of a year to call somebody and wish him a happy birthday? Do you have any idea how difficult that is? And I said, yeah. And he said, then why did you hang up on him? And I said, because he's a drunk. And my sponsor looked at him at me and said, you're a drunk? Oh. And he said, you owe him an amend. And I said, I don't get it. And he said, you held him at arm's length your whole life because he was alcoholic. You never gave him a chance. You never tried to understand his alcoholism. You never did anything for him. You never tried to create a relationship with him, even when he was trying to touch you in the depths of his alcoholism. And I said, Jesus, he's living in a veterans hospital, had a stroke, can't even speak, is in a wheelchair. The nurses there are telling us that he has no capacity for continuous thought. I mean, his mind's fried. What would be the point of going there and telling him that I regret having treated him that way? Yeah. He said, quote, I don't give a good goddamn what you think. You clean off your side of the street, and that means you get in your car and drive to Wisconsin, and you go up there and tell him whether he understands or not that you regret having treated him that way. That's the kind of sponsorship I have. So I did. I'll tell you the net result of it, because that's what happened. I drove to Wisconsin, and there's a little town up there by the Chain of Lakes called King, Wisconsin. And there's this Wisconsin veterans home there. And I went in there, and I went up to the floor he was supposed to be on. And I said, I'm looking for a guy named Bob Olson, because he has the same name I do. And he said, and the nurse said, that's him right over there. And there's this little old man over there in the chair, in this wheelchair. And I hadn't seen him in a long, long time. I mean, he'd been off on a running drunk forever, and I hadn't seen him in probably 10, 12 years. And so I went over there, and he looked up and didn't, I don't think he recognized me. And I looked at him and I said, "Hi, I'm your son, Bob." And then he woke up, kind of. And I said, I need to talk with you, and I'd like to do that kind of away from all these people. And I asked the nurse where we could go, and she directed us into this little room. So I went in there with him, and I sat down in front of him, and I said, I did what the book said. I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And when I said that, he got sad. Remember, he couldn't say a word. He was half paralyzed. And I said, "I'm an alcoholic," and he really looked like he got sad. And I said, "But I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm practicing this recovery program. And part of the recovery is that I've created harm in your life, and I'd like to make that right. And here's the harm that I created." And I described it to him, and I said, I regret having done that, and I'd like to know whatever I could do to make that right. And there's no way, I mean, this is like talking to the wall. And I said, "But I don't drink anymore." And when I said, "I don't drink anymore," he became visibly elated. And then I understood that he understood. And I told him that that I loved him, and I was sorry I had treated him that way, and I didn't know what to do, but if I could, if God ever told me how to make his life better, I would do it. And it, shortly thereafter, he died. So my dad died from gangrene. He was... he had adult onset diabetes, type 2 diabetes, and they'd at that point in time they weren't really didn't know how to manage diabetes well, and they had to start, they had to amputate his feet, and I have one, he had one brother, and they would call his brother and they would say, "Well, we're going to have to cut his feet off, so." We need your permission to do that. So he would give him permission, and then they'd amputate his feet. And the problem with type 2 diabetes is that you lose circulation in your extremities, both your arms and your legs. And if you don't manage the diabetes well, you eventually, they just keep taking them off. And then they were going to amputate his legs up closer to his thighs. And they were talking about losing an arm. And they finally went to my uncle and said, "Well, we can just keep taking pieces off of him. But at some point, this is going to kill him. And you want to let him die now, or you want to just keep taking parts off?" And it was my uncle's opinion that they ought to let him die. And I've never argued with that. I'm glad I wasn't asked that question. And so he thought the kindest thing was to let him die, and so they did. At some level, my father understood that and couldn't speak. And so when people came around him, he would scream at them. The four horsemen of alcoholism are terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And from my point of view, despair is the worst. My father lived in despair. He lived in despair because other people were making decisions about him dying and he had nothing to do with it. And he couldn't even speak to tell them what he thought. And that's how he died. He died like a drunk dies. My father was married 9 times, 9 different women. And when he died, the only people that showed up were his son, his daughter, and his uncle, and his brother. And out of all those people that touched his life. And that was only out of a sense of obligation. Okay, that's what drunks do. That's how drunks die. If you have someone in your life that you need to make amends to, and especially if it's a family member, do it before they die. Do it before you can't do it. So just suck it up and go do it. Okay? Now. Yeah.
You said that, it's a scary purpose, a beautiful thing, it's also done by after you give your skill, this is what I know, how I achieve what I did.
Yes.
Is there anything to do about that moment when I had to go to work, and I did not be so annoyed.
Right.
That's one of the scariest things I've ever done. But I was wondering if you have any experience with anything
that reasons,
you
said. Yeah. Yes. Right. You know what my ex-wife said? Marry me again. I went, that's not reasonable. No, we don't belong together and I'm not going to be there. And it, you know, you have your own purposes for wanting me there. I'm not going to be a part of that ever again. So sometimes people will ask you to do something that's unreasonable. And I was a bill collector in Chicago. Weighed 240 pounds, used to kick in people's doors. This was before they had consumer protection laws. And we were just told to go get the money. And so, and I did that for several years. And really abused some people badly. And I went to my sponsor and said, if I go try and make that right, I'm going to get shot. Because some of those people were dangerous people. And he said, you're protected. You got to be kidding. This is one of those hardest things about trusting God is trusting God. And he said, you're protected. And trying to believe that was nice, but my practical sense said, no, there's no way to be protected. Yeah. And he said what he always said, I don't care what you think. Your best thinking got you here. And so I went to them. And called them, and some of them wouldn't talk to me at all. Some of them just hang up, and I'd say, can I have just a moment of your time? I'd like to make amends for how I treated you. Some people, I guess, were curious enough to see me. And most of that was about abuse. I didn't steal from them. It was all about just treating people badly. I mean, physically badly. Some people, I remember going to one family and saying, I regret having done that. Is there anything I can do that to make that right? And the answer was, stay the hell away from me. Other people said, well, we're really happy that your life changed. I guess maybe God works. And you get all kinds of funny stuff. The tough part is, am I willing to go do that? I didn't think it was unreasonable. I thought that I was afraid to do it. I thought it was above and beyond the call of duty, frankly. and going to some of those people and that I had just treated horribly and saying I'd like to make it right. And nobody made any unreasonable demands in that area. Okay. I had to pay back an enormous amount of money. Well, it was enormous back then. And what I did was I made a list of all these people, and I went and had it checked with my sponsor, and I said, how do I do this? And he said, you got to pay each one of them a little bit every month. And I said, come on. They don't want $50 or $35 or whatever. These guys want it all at once. And he said, no, that's your ego. You want to walk in there like some big goddamn deal and hand them the whole thing and say, there you go, now we're all square. And he said, that isn't going to work. So for the next 2.5 years, I took 30% of my net income and paid it out as amends. 2.5 years. And I thought it was never going to go away. I'll tell you the funny thing that happened. I've always loved boats. I grew up in Wisconsin, lots of lakes, you know. And I always thought that if you ever had a boat, then you were rich, okay? Because I grew up in real rank kind of poverty. And I thought if a guy ever owned a boat, he was on top of the world. So I always wanted at some point in my life to own a boat. And we had been really living close to the vest for 2.5 years, and I had these two sons. And that one day I said, to hell with it, let's go to the boat show. So I went to this boat show, and we were hanging around in there, and the Bassmasters were there. And they said they had a raffle on this bass boat, and it was like 3 tickets for $10. And these guys had $10 before I knew I even had it on my pocket. And I'm going, that's the dumbest damn thing I ever did. And I felt like Jack and the Beanstalk trading the cows for beans, you know? And I thought, I really messed up here. And I still had the tail end of my amends. I still owed $2,500. So we went home, and I was talking to my wife, and she said, how'd it go? And I said, I really did something stupid. I took a chance on a boat for $10, and I don't know what the hell I was thinking. And they called me the next day and told me I won the boat. And the boat, wholesale, was the cost of the rest of my amends. So I went down to the boat show again, and I walked in there, and I said, I have that winning ticket for the boat. And I took my two sons with me, who were like this big. And they jump up in the boat, and they're climbing around going, hey, Dad, we're going to go fishing. This is really going to be good. We could pull water skiers with this. This is really cool. Can we take this boat home? And this Texan came up to me, and he said, you want to sell that boat? And I said, for how much? And he said, $2,500. Back then, that was a wholesale cost on a Rebel bass boat, right? And so what do you do? Do you sell a boat and pay your amends? Or do you keep the boat and keep paying off your amends? What do you do? Here's the line I hate in the book, all right? The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Oh. And I had to go to my kids and say, guys, we gotta trade this boat off so I can pay off the rest of my debt. But I promise you at some point we will have a boat and it'll be every bit as nice as this. But at this point I have to follow my conscience and I have to sell this boat, and I apologize to you for doing that. Ugh. So I met this Texan the next day, and he gave me 25 $100 bills, and I was out of debt for the first time in my adult life. 3 years later, I bought a 17 and a half foot, what the hell is that? Kind of boat, a killer boat. It had a Boss 3 in it that you could troll at 60 miles an hour. It was just a killer boat. And we had more fun with that boat after that. But that at some point, we will be faced with this idea about, am I willing to do what's right? Am I going to stand up for what I believe? Okay? Now, there, for me, going to people in Chicago that I had physically abused was, from my point of view, a dangerous proposition. Some of those people hated me with a vengeance. There were people who would lock their houses when I came around. There were people who would bring me peace offerings. They'd bring me like baskets full of berries and shit like that, just so I wouldn't come out there and go after them. People would say to me, I remember I was making amends to one guy in Chicago, and he said, Bob, you know, the scary thing about you wasn't that you were so big. The scary thing about you is when I looked in your eyes, there was nobody in there. Okay. I sponsored a guy, and he gave me permission to tell the story, so I'll tell you about it. When he went through the work the first time, the only amend he didn't make was an amend to an employer. And what he'd done, he worked on structural steel. This guy's about 6'5" and looks like he got chiseled out of a piece of stone. It's the toughest man I ever met in my life. Big Polish kid. And what he had done was he had hurt himself playing touch football with a bunch of his buddies, drunk, and he faked an injury on the job so he could get medical coverage. It cost $60,000 for them to fix his leg, and it was all a bogus deal, all a framed up deal. And he wouldn't make the amend. This guy's name is Mike. And I kept telling him, Mike, you make that amend or you'll drink again, so help me. And he said, I can't make the amend. It's $60,000. I'm going to wind up in Joliet, which is a state prison. And I said, you know, sometimes the hardest thing about trusting God is trusting God. And maybe God's bigger than your amend. So he said, I really don't want to do this because I'm screwed. I mean, I'll go to prison. Way too much money. And I said, well, okay, but I think you'll drink again. And then he came back and he said, I'm going to go to Chicago and make that right. So he goes to Chicago and he's calling me. He drives out there and he's calling me as he's going out there. He'd stop at some place and get on the phone. He'd go, I am scared to death. This is the biggest, toughest man I've ever met. I have met some tough people. And he's calling me and he's going, I am scared to death, Bob. And I said, God's with you. Just get it out of the way so you don't have to spend the rest of your life worrying about what you did. So he goes into this company and he said, hi, I'm Mike so-and-so. I used to work for you. I scammed you out of $60,000 with a trumped up injury. I'm here to make that right. I regret having done that. And so whatever I have to do, just let me know. And the president of the company and the treasurer of that company, a big construction company, were the people he made the amend to. And they said, you'll have to come back tomorrow. So So he goes home and he calls me, or he goes back to the motel and he calls me and he goes, they're gonna be waiting there. Oh yeah, I mean, there's gonna be a blue and white, which is a Chicago police car. Yeah, they're gonna be sitting there with a blue and white, and I'm done. And I said, trust God. Try to get a good night's sleep. Jesus, I just.
There's somebody in there you need to talk to.
Oh man. So he goes back in the next day, no cop. And he's sitting there with the treasurer of this corporation. And the treasurer said, you in a 12-step program? And he said, yeah. And the treasurer said, you scammed us out of $60,000 and Mike says, yeah. And the treasurer said, well, you know our insurance company paid for that. And he said, okay. And so the treasurer of the company said, I want you to take $600 and pay it to a charity of our choice in front of us. And Mike said, what else can I do? And he said, that's it. And he had been running for his life for years for fear that he was going to get caught and prosecuted for that deal. All right? See, the only way that you will ever learn to trust God is to proceed when you have no resources left, where you are at the, where you virtually are at God's mercy, and then put yourself in that position and see what happens. Okay? Now, I didn't like making amends to my dad. I didn't like making amends to all those people I used to collect money from. I don't like any of that. Do you know that that all assaults your ego? Part of the ego deflation of this program is going to do things like that and making it right. But at some point, you'll be able to walk down the street and you won't have to cross the street for anyone. Okay? You won't worry. There was a point after that first inventory and certainly after subsequent inventories when I didn't owe anybody anything. I was completely clean. I didn't have to look over my shoulder about anything. And that is a feeling that I had never experienced before. So, and some of this, here's an example. I went into the First National Bank one day. And I was mad at them because they had, I don't know whether they'd screwed up an account, they did something, anyway, I was really irritated with the bank. I hadn't bounced any checks or done anything like that. Maybe they didn't respond fast enough, or it was just some goofy thing where I was mad at them. And so I go through and I make a deposit and I get some cash back and all that, and they give me $20 too much, right? And I went, good, now I got them. And I drove off and promptly forgot about the whole thing. 2 years later, I remembered that they gave me too much money. Now what do you do? Right, well, it just popped in my head and I thought, wait a minute. So I went to the bank and I said, excuse me, who would I see about getting too much money in the drive-thru? And they said, bookkeeping. And I said, all right, where's bookkeeping? And they said, downstairs. So I went downstairs and I went up to this lady in bookkeeping and I said, I came through the drive-thru and you gave me $20 too much and I want to give it back. And she said, today? And I said, no. And she said, yesterday? And I said, no, 2 years ago. And she looked at me like I was nuts. And this other lady came up and looked around the corner and she said, "Oh, I know him. He does stuff like that." Okay. You willing to look like a fool? Sometimes living a spiritual life is looking like a fool. You don't have to protect your ego. In fact, you got to deflate it. So are you willing to do stuff like that? What other kind of amends do you make? Huh?
Places.
Tell me about it. Tell me about making amends. Where? What else do you do? What other kind of amends are there? Yeah. Huh?
Yeah, living amends.
Living amends. How do you do that? Don't die. Yeah. Huh?
There's some places on one of my amends where I have to repay money back to the establishment that they were no longer in business, and it was a sum of money. And my sponsor at the time told me to pick a charity.
Yeah.
May start donating money or doing something to.
And did you do that? Let me give you an example of living amends. How are we doing? How are we doing here? I don't know when this one stops. Okay. I've been married twice. And the last marriage I had three children. Right now I have an 18-year-old who just went off to Southern Methodist University, and two 14-year-olds, twins. And the first 10 years of marriage were wonderful. And the next 6 or 7 years were just horrible. And so we decided that we really didn't belong together, and we were divorced. It was really hard on my kids. And although we didn't much care for each other, their mother and I, we care very much for our children. And as a consequence, tried to do that together with as little damage to the children as possible. So after that happened, it was terrible. I mean, I lived in this big house and all this, and all of a sudden I'm living in a two-bedroom townhouse, and I got three kids. And I just felt awful. I felt like I was a bad father, you know, I just, and I wrote a whole lot of inventory about it. And one of the things that I found out was the last few years I was married, she and I were so angry at each other that it took all the focus in the family. And so the amend that I had to make to my children was that I hadn't given them a fair shake for years. And that I was so focused on my anger that I really wasn't as good a father as I could have been. And that I didn't pay as much attention to them as I could have. And that I wasn't going to do that anymore. That what I was going to do is I was going to pay a lot of attention to them. I was going to spend a lot of time telling them how much I loved them. And that I was going to try and make their life as pleasant as possible. And I do that. And that's a living amend. Those kids know that they can come to me for anything or about anything, and that I will do everything within my power to support them in any manner that won't be harmful to them. And they're just nuts about me. They just love me. You know, I've got five kids that just love the hell out of me, and I got two grandchildren that just love the hell out of me. And how'd that happen? Part of that is this business about changing your mind from where's mine to what can I do for you. All right? What other kind of amends are there?
I had to do one posthumously.
How'd you do it?
I'd write it out, and showed it to my sponsor, and he said, address it to heaven and stick it in the mail.
And what happened?
And I was no longer pissed at my dad.
Did the post office take it?
I don't know. I'd put it in a box, and, you know, in a regular mailbox.
Right.
I don't know where it went.
Would have been gone to a dead letter center. They surely get a bunch of stuff like that.
Santa Claus.
Right. There's another way that people do that, and that is that they go to the graveyard.
Right. He's in Arkansas.
Oh, okay.
I couldn't afford to.
Okay. If their people are close, they'll go to their graves, huh?
I did a graveyard.
Did you? How'd that work? Good. Good. In fear of you? Yeah. Right. That's great.
He came out of that just enough to recognize who I was and myself here in his eyes. It's not like I can see him. They heard me. He was going to the grave. He didn't want to go down
there. Right.
About 9 months before he died, we kind of made our peace with each other. I thought.
Right. Well, if he was taking a lot of morphine, his mind wouldn't have been working real well anyway.
No, but if you'd have seen his eyes, you'd know what I was talking about. I could get that out of my mind. So that's what I wanted to do.
That can be drug-induced paranoia.
Could have been.
Yeah, but it's scary and no matter what.
He was afraid of me, and rightfully so. I was on crank when I let him know how I felt about him.
Oh, man.
He could kill him. And, so he had the right to be.
Right. Right. Huh.
So, but going to that graveyard and making that amends. I think when you make a living amends, if you make amends to someone that's alive, it's about freeing both people. I think it's possible that they can be free, and we can be free at the same time, beyond the grave. If
yeah.
That way, to me, when it was all said and done, there was a fuse that came over and came down. And that sounds crazy, but I think my dad is.
Why is that crazy? All right.
We talk.
Good. Never question anyone else's spiritual experience. I had the feeling you were going to say something. No?
Over there at Mother's Lodge for years and years, something like that.
Right. Did he just not want to be beholden to you? Right.
And I just, you know, he said that, I still showed up every week, only once, but probably every week, 2 years before I said anything, how much more my mom was going. But when he died, you know, we had the closest relationship with about 7 kids. And
it seems like if you really didn't want your mom here, I would have hired a neighbor to get the most of it. Probably wants to.
What other kind of amends can you make? How about financial amends? How do you do that?
I thought we already talked about that.
No, we can talk about it some more.
I had some creditors. I paid off the last ones about a year and a half ago. I had 3 creditors that were after me, and they kept hounding me offers on the amount that I owed.
What do you think of that?
I haggled with them.
Okay.
And they gave me a final price, and I agreed to it and paid them off.
Do you know the book says that when it talks about creditors, it says make the best deal you can. Yeah, and that means you don't have to lay down. Well, yeah.
The creditor that came after me, it had been like 13, 15 years ago, so I knew that even though it was on my record, they sold that thing to a company. So the company bought that on the.
Well, bought the debt?
So I knew that the full value that they were, you know, that was a question.
I'll tell you, after I paid off my debts originally, I was in a business. Actually, I was in 2 businesses, and I had to close one. And when I closed it, it had $250,000 in debt. And I went to the bank, and I said, where the debt was, and I said, I have no idea how I'm going to do this, but I'll make it right. And they were the ones that said, I'd get that thing shut down before it goes any further in debt. And I said, I don't want to do that to you. And they said, we'll be fine, but just... Actually, they were the nicest people. And so I said, okay. And I was telling my sponsor, I said, Jesus, I have no idea how I'm going to pay that back. I've got this other business, and it's successful, but it isn't going to just pop a $250,000 like that. And 90 days later, it was paid off. Weirdest set of circumstances you ever saw. And I went back to my sponsor and I said, you know, it took me 2.5 years before to pay off all this debt. And now I've got a debt that was 10 times that size. And it was paid off in 90 days. How do you explain that? And he said, it doesn't require explanation. And I said, why not? And he said, God's got all the money he needs. You know, I think that God honors your action. I think if you get it in your head that you want to make it right and you go do everything you can, I think that God helps you find a way to do it. And frankly, most people are even afraid to start. And the only way that you're ever going to learn to trust God is by putting yourself in that position where it's virtually impossible for you to do something that you really should do, and then you do it. And that's the way you learn to trust God. You know, just leading a life where everything's hunky-dory and, you know, everything comes up aces and all the rest of that, you don't learn a damn thing. All you learn is that you ought to be riding high for the rest of your life. But the book talks about certain trials and low spots ahead. And it's not joking. There are certain trials and low spots ahead. It isn't like maybe. It's like this stuff's going to come along, and you better have a program when it does, because that's what's going to save your life. Got any other ideas about amends? Allison, have you made amends yet?
I've made three.
Have you? Mm-hmm. How'd that go?
Pretty well.
Yeah.
I did my mom and my stepdad. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't very scary because I knew they were already. I knew they weren't going to demand anything crazy from me.
Yes.
No, they already loved me. And they were still scary. But. Because the cool thing that happened was my mom, she was the first one I made, and she started as soon as I gave her stop, she starts rattling off all the things she's sorry for, and it's like my second column, all the stuff I was mad about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, wow, okay. Right? So it was good for her too. And then I already forgive her and all that. So I was a little